Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, Appalachia as canary in the coal mine, a warning for what will afflict the rest of the country if we don't pay attention. We'll spend this hour with Jeff Young, managing editor of a journalism collective reporting on social and economic change in Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia, places hit hard by the collapse in demand for coal, by polluted air and water, and by disease and opioid abuse. But the story of modern Appalachia is not one strictly of despair. We'll also hear about environmental and labor advocates trying to hold mining companies accountable, and about entrepreneurs working to diversify an economy once defined by a single industry. Our conversation starts after a short break. What you want about coal, it's an antiquated fuel source, dangerous for miners to extract and bad for the environment to burn. But let's get something straight. The Industrial Revolution that began America's transformation from agrarian backwater to economic superpower, that revolution was powered by coal. And as prices collapsed due to declining demand, we should consider what we owe the parts of America that provided that fuel for many decades, only to find themselves facing an uncertain future. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Jeff Young is managing editor of Ohio Valley Resource. That's a regional journalism collaborative that's been reporting on economic and social change in Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia since 2016. Young wants us all to understand that coal-producing states are more complex than the stereotypes many of us hold without ever having visited, and also that their problems today offer a glimpse at what may be coming for the rest of the country and also a prime opportunity to explore solutions. His book is called Appalachian Fall, Dispatches from Coal Country on What is Ailing America. Jeff, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the program, Chris.
So you grew up in West Virginia, and when you were a kid, this ad used to play on TV that you never forgot. I want to play some of that.
Coal is West Virginia. Coal is me and you. Coal is West Virginia. We've got a job to do.
All right, coal is West Virginia. Jeff, what was the point of that campaign, and what made you think about the song when you were reporting on Appalachia for Ohio Valley Resource?
Well, thanks for playing it. Boy, that brings back memories. Not as a child, of course, but later in life, I would often think back on that advertisement, which was, you couldn't turn on the television without seeing it if you grew up in that region in that era. And what were they selling is the question I kept coming back to. It's not like I'm going to, you know, go down to the IGA grocery and buy me a lump of coal, right? So what they're selling is this notion that, as the swelling chorus there puts it, coal is this place. The inverse of that is, without coal, you're nothing, right? That's a pretty bold statement. Later on, as I started in my journalism career and reporting on coal and becoming more aware of a lot of the problems associated with the industry, that question kept tugging at me. You know, if the industry is selling us this notion that coal is West Virginia, and that narrative has been really successful in framing a lot of people's thinking about the region, what are we without it? And here we are in a position where not just West Virginia, but a lot of coal-dependent communities need to figure that out. Because even though the writing's been on the wall for quite a long time that coal jobs were in sharp decline and that coal-dependent communities needed a more diverse way to generate revenue and jobs, unfortunately, not a lot of their political leaders did the appropriate amount of planning for that. And so now, suddenly, they find themselves in a tight place.
What did you and your colleagues in this reporting collective want to achieve with this project that has not been done elsewhere?
Well, a few things. I think it's even within the region, but especially outside the region and for a national audience, I don't think there is an adequate understanding of just how profound a change this is. And I don't think there is sufficient acknowledgement and respect for the contributions that the Appalachian region and other coal-producing areas made for the country. And thank you, by the way, for the way you started our conversation by making that acknowledgement that these are the communities and these are the families, because coal is often an intergenerational sort of job. These are the folks that built this country to a large degree, right? They powered the Industrial Revolution. They powered the war machine that defeated fascism in the middle of the 20th century. And now that we're not using coal anymore, are those communities and those people just going to be treated as disposable? And are they going to be left with all of the legacy costs that have been piling up and not addressed for decades and decades? And these are now bills that are coming due in the form of damaged lands, polluted waterways, people who are suffering various ailments, either from being in the industry or living near the extraction or downwind of the burning of coal. And then, of course, there's that great big unaccounted cost in the sky that we call climate change, right? So we were aiming to, by stitching together a lot of the different types of reporting that we've been doing about coal-dependent communities and the region, to try to give a more nuanced view and a greater appreciation for, as I mentioned, those contributions. And the other thing that we discovered through our reporting is that this region, which is, let's face it, largely by the rest of the nation considered to be a backwater, really looks more like a bellwether when you begin to look at some of the major issues that our country is facing. I mentioned climate change. That's one where I think the path to solutions to climate change goes straight through energy-producing regions like Appalachia. The opioid crisis is another example where we saw the first and worst effects of it here in our region. The place right where I grew up, near Huntington, West Virginia, was essentially ground zero for this horrible opioid crisis, which is now a national crisis to such a profound degree that the deaths of despair from overdoses and things associated with addiction are pulling down the life expectancy of the whole country. So we wanted to put those ideas before a broader audience.
So why is Appalachia treated or talked about like it's a kind of backwater, as you say, that is separate from the rest of the United States when we consider, say, the Midwest, the heartland, as like an integral part of the country?
Well, that's a good question. This is a little beyond my area of expertise, but what I know from talking with folks a lot smarter than me about this very question is that it is closely tied to the history of resource extraction from the country. So the first wave of resource extraction for Appalachia came in the form of the Big Cut, cutting the timber from the Appalachian hills. And shortly after that, you saw the pursuit of coal and other natural resources, but those were the two dominant ones. Well, people lived on the land where the timber was and were making a living as settlers and small-scale farmers. People lived on the land that was over top of the coal. So the entities that needed access to these natural resources also needed a way to displace or diminish the power of the people who lived there. And that, in a nutshell, is the story of why Appalachia is considered something other than the rest of the country. This is a gross oversimplification, I know, but to me, it really rings true the more you read about the history of the place and understand the patterns that are still in place here, that there was an effort to displace early settlers from their land. And in the process, to make the people themselves seem somehow unworthy of the riches that they were sitting on top of. Just look at those lazy hillbillies. They're not doing anything with the coal. So why shouldn't we move them aside in pursuit of this for the greater good? That sort of thing. Again, gross oversimplification, I know, but this is a common thread that you come across a lot in a lot of academic and, you know, histories of Appalachia.
So now, as the coal industry declines and has been denigrated for its environmental costs, a lot of coal miners feel unfairly disrespected. I want to listen to Charles Stanley talk about that.
It was coal miners that put this nation on the map. Without coal, there would have been no Industrial Revolution. There would be no New York City. There would be no L.A. There would be nothing on these grounds of this United States, this great nation that we live in, if it hadn't come from the backs of a coal miner.
What is Charles Stanley's life like today?
Well, so Charles, he went by Wayne, Charles Wayne Stanley. That's the very first person you hear from in chapter one of the book. And I chose him because he so eloquently and passionately expressed this idea that you hear over and over again from coal miners and folks in coal communities. And that is that they don't feel like they've been given their adequate due or recognition for the contributions that they've made to the country. So that's why we gave him, the first, made him the first voice that you hear. At the time of the interview, he was 53 years old, and we encountered him as part of an investigation into a resurgence of black lung disease. This was an investigation that we did in partnership with NPR, and the leader of that investigation is Howard Berkus. I want to make sure I give a shout out to Howard for his great work, not just on this, but just generally being a great guy. But especially on this project, he really dug in. And with our help, we arranged dozens of interviews with miners affected by black lung. And the interviews took place in or near black lung clinics around the region. Mr. Stanley and his family live in the western part of Virginia. Not West Virginia, western part of Virginia, just across the state line from eastern Kentucky. And at the time of the interview, he was ill, but you can tell from his voice, he was, you know, still doing okay. However, unfortunately, by the time the book came out, just a few weeks after the book was published, he died. He's gone. And I've had a chance to speak with his wife, a lovely, strong woman who appreciated the fact that Mr. Stanley got, you know, that his voice was prominent in the book and in our reporting. And she put out a call for his fellow miners to be pallbearers at his funeral. And they wore their mining gear and boots to carry him the last little bit.
What does modern coal mining entail? Like, what is the work day for someone who mines coal for a living?
Well, it's a highly automated industry. And so a lot of the work that goes on is actually pretty sophisticated and very specialized in terms of the equipment that they deal with and the communications that they have. There's, of course, two very different kinds of mining in Appalachia, the underground mining and then the surface mining. Surface mining has become somewhat dominant, or had become until very recently. And that is even more automated and is, you know, essentially the workers are operating very, very large scale heavy equipment and demolishing the tops of mountains in order to get to the layers of coal underneath, and then disposing of the waste in nearby valleys, that sort of thing. Underground work is still dangerous. I think the industry has made some strides in safety. In fact, I think this year will wind up as the safest year on record in terms of fatalities. But again, that's largely due to the fact that there simply aren't that many people mining now.
My guest is Jeff Young, managing editor of Ohio Valley Resource. That's a regional journalism collective. His book is called Appalachian Fall: Dispatches from Coal Country on What's Ailing America. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jeff Young. He's managing editor of a regional journalism collaborative that is reporting on economic and social change in Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia. His book is called Appalachian Fall: Dispatches from Coal Country on What's Ailing America. Jeff, is mining still largely the work of men, or are there women in the mines now too?
There are women. That was a change that came about, oh gosh, I would say late 80s, early 90s, you started seeing some women entering that workforce. It is, however, male dominated. It's also more diverse racially than many people realize. There are quite a few communities all around Appalachia that were settled by African Americans and various waves of immigrant labor that were that came into the area to work in the mines. The boom-bust cycle of coal means that a lot of those communities now are just shadows of what they once were, but a lot of the folks who settled there still remain. And now the folks who are bearing the brunt of the illnesses from occupational hazards like black lung, those burdens are also scattered among those communities there, and a lot of the folks who still live in these places that were once coal camps and bustling with activity are now primarily they're getting older, and they're a little older and a little sicker, frankly, than the larger population, and so their needs are much greater.
I think a lot of people have known about black lung disease, even if they live far outside of coal country, but this book really drives home that what was once a disease that hit miners quite late in life has now begun to take its toll on very young people.
That's true. One of the folks that we interviewed as part of this project to reach out to the people affected by this resurgence of the disease is a young man, still in his 30s, from Eastern Kentucky, named Mackie Branham Jr. And it was really difficult just listening to the interview because the poor guy couldn't complete a sentence without gasping for breath. He's got children and a wife. He's the primary breadwinner for the family. And you could tell right away that it really hurt his pride and his sense of identity in addition to the physical ailment itself. Not being able to provide for his family was a real blow. And this is unfortunately very common. The short version of what's been happening is, as we have exhausted the easier seams of coal to mine, the coal that remains is in thinner seams, and the rock layers in between produce very toxic dust because of the silica content in the rock. And the more powerful mining equipment that became available in recent decades meant that you could cut through that rock to get to the next layer of coal. The miners call it the middleman. It's the rock in between the stuff that they want to get to. And the dust that is generated by that is far more toxic and appears to be contributing to this resurgence in the disease. It is entirely, entirely preventable. And it is shocking that the industry and our regulators, government regulators, did not do more. They knew that this was a risk. And this was the upshot of the investigation that we did with NPR's Howard Berkus. And here we are now with thousands of people essentially doomed. Once you contract especially this advanced form of black lung, it's just a matter of time. And there really is no cure other than getting a lung transplant.
Here's Mackie Branham.
The more I talk, the more I get out of breath. And it's like me trying to blow up like a new balloon. It's just a lot of pressure. I can no longer provide for my family. And I can't do nothing around the house like I normally would. It tires your nerves up.
I mean, the thought, Jeff, of him living his life, as you said, in his 30s, it sounds like his entire life has lived like he's just run up six flights of stairs.
Yeah. It's really hard. We had such an outpouring of people when we first aired that story, wanting to help the family, and they refused it. They thought, well, we're not in need. There are a lot of other people in much greater need than we are. And they instead directed people to make contributions to some other local charities. They're just remarkable people, and it says so much about the character of folks. Of course, I'm a little biased, having grown up in the region. But I put this in the category of this is the sacrifice that this region made, and this is the cost that is yet to be addressed. We've all of us have benefited from this cheap, and you can't see my air quotes, but cheap in quotes, form of energy. Really, what we've done collectively is just ignored the true costs, right? And now the true costs are coming due in the form of Mackie Branham Jr.'s diseased lungs, in the form of mountains that have been blown apart, in the form of toxic waste dumps produced by the burning of coal, where the ash is left behind all over the Midwest, all in Texas as well. There are so many unaccounted for costs here. And now the industry is kind of winding down, at least in Appalachia, and probably soon throughout other parts of the country. What's going to become of all of these legacy costs? Who's going to pay for all of these sick miners and their health costs? There's a federal trust fund that was set up very wisely long ago to look after sick miners and their dependents and soon to be widows in many cases. But that fund is in billions of dollars of debt. And our Congress has not acted to make sure that the tax on the industry that is supposed to keep that fund afloat will continue. So there are lots of examples of how we collectively as a society have not really addressed those full costs. And again, the big cost is climate change, the one that we have not addressed.
We'll get to climate change, I promise, before the hour is up. But I do want to talk for a moment about the kinds of business and legal strategies that the mining companies themselves have used to sidestep their financial obligations to sick and injured workers.
Well, so I think the case that we have followed that is probably the poster child for this right now would be a mining company called Black Jewel. Some of your listeners might recognize the name because that company made some headlines a little over a year ago when the miners were suddenly left without jobs. And because the company went bankrupt just overnight, filed bankruptcy. And in addition to just filing bankruptcy, they clawed back the last paychecks that they had given to the miners. The guys had already, you know, had the money in the bank and then went to pay their bills and discovered their paychecks had been revoked, essentially. So these are guys who didn't have a union, but they took what is typically considered a union-like action. And they staged a protest. They scrambled out onto some railroad tracks and blocked the last load of coal that they themselves had dug from a mine in right on the Kentucky-Virginia border, and demanded that they get their pay. And they stayed there for the better part of a month on those railroad tracks. So this really brought a spotlight on the what's going on with coal company bankruptcies. And bankruptcy court is vulnerable to some manipulation by industry in order to escape some of the costs. And quite often what happens in bankruptcy is that if the company remains an entity at the end of it, they shed their debt. And often the debt is in the form of the obligations to workers, pensions, healthcare benefits, things like that. They also shed their debt in regards to the obligation to repair the land that they have damaged in the process of mining. And of course, those costs come back to you and me, the taxpayers, eventually. Or they are costs that are passed on to the people who live in the immediate vicinity of the mining and have to deal with mudslides and erosion and runoff and et cetera from unrepaired lands. So this is a huge, huge problem. Billions and billions of dollars of these obligations are just walked away from by the industry.
There are entire communities where people have to buy bottled water for drinking, even for brushing their teeth. How does coal mining affect regional water supplies unless somebody's just exceptionally careful about that?
Well, this is complex. You know, in some of these communities, which were essentially established as you know, places where the workers lived for mining, the water systems were themselves built by the companies, the mine companies. However, when the companies went out of business or you know, no longer needed to be operating in that region, they would frequently abandon the operation of those water systems. So that's one part of the problem. Another part of the problem is a chronic underinvestment in infrastructure. And this is one that we see highly, lots of examples of this throughout our region. The one we focus on in the book is Martin County, Kentucky, where, you know, this is a place that mined just hundreds of millions of dollars worth of coal, but retained very little of that value for their own needs, and now cannot reliably deliver clean water to all of the residents in the county, even though it's a very small rural area. And then, of course, there is the direct impact of pollution from mining itself. And this is a very big deal for a lot of the more rural residents who still rely on well water. The underground mining, the effects of dumping of waste into streams, and in some cases, the injection of slurry waste from mining into the old mine voids or into the ground. These are all things that have affected water supplies and water quality. And there are a lot of people who question the safety of their water supplies or have simply found that their wells went dry because of the effects of mining affecting the water table.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Jeff, why is it worse for the climate to burn coal for energy than even petroleum?
So coal is the most carbon intensive of our fossil fuels. So that means that for every unit of energy that you get from burning a lump of coal, you produce more CO2 compared to burning other fossil fuels. So natural gas is a good comparison here. The burning of natural gas releases far less CO2 per unit of energy that you get from it. So that coupled with the longevity of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere means that we've been building up a big carbon debt from burning coal, and it's still up there. It's not like, you know, burning coal from 50 years ago, all of it went away. Hmm. It's unfortunately still hanging around. For that reason, coal has been, you know, among the major contributors to the problems that we are now beginning to fully realize with climate change.
And it's not the people in this part of the country who make their living mining coal are not aware of these problems. They just might not have other options for jobs, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's been some very interesting public opinion polling in the region that shows quite a bit of support for clean energy, for even taxing CO2 emissions or putting a price on CO2 emissions, which is pretty interesting given the attitudes of elected leaders from the region. There's a bit of a disconnect, in my opinion, between the generally held public opinion and what is reflected in Congress from people elected from this region and et cetera. But yeah, really the nub of it is, especially for very coal-dependent communities in the central Appalachia region, that there has been underinvestment in other forms of economic activity. There's been very little development of an entrepreneurial middle class in a lot of these communities. It's the classic resource curse, you know, where the place that has all this mineral wealth doesn't necessarily benefit from it. People elsewhere get quite rich, But the immediate effect for the place where you're getting this resource out of the ground is that they get stuck with a lot of the costs and they don't realize a lot of the benefits from it. And we see over and over again example of that. There's been underinvestment in education, underinvestment in infrastructure, and these are all things that are going to need to be addressed if the region is going to be able to make some kind of a transition. And I think this question of a just transition as we address climate change is going to have to include Appalachia and its needs.
There are retraining programs, but getting new job skills doesn't mean that an employer will automatically materialize wanting to hire for those skills.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, job training is great, right? But training doesn't create a job. So where are those folks going to work? This was a question that we had in mind when we profiled a community in eastern Ohio where a power plant that has been there for a good long while is shutting down, Conesville in eastern Ohio. And so that's the challenge that they're up against. They're doing great work on the ground of trying to provide training. They're, you know, taking these folks who had worked their entire careers in the power plant. They've never had to do a job interview or write a resume or things like that. So they're getting that kind of assistance and training, but in most cases, they're going to have to go to, say, Columbus or north up toward Cleveland, where there are jobs. There just aren't that many jobs immediately surrounding the places that are most directly affected by the cutbacks in mining and the cutbacks in power plants and things like that. In addition, it's not just the jobs. It's the source of revenue that those places offered for the surrounding communities, which has now been gone, that funded schools and other services.
My guest is Jeff Young. He's a journalist and author of Appalachian Fall, Dispatches from Coal Country on What's Ailing America. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jeff Young. He's managing editor of Ohio Valley Resource. That's a regional journalism collaborative that's been reporting on economic and social change in Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia. He's out with a new book called Appalachian Fall, Dispatches from Coal Country on What's Ailing America. David is calling from San Francisco. Hi, David.
Oh, yeah. Hi. I studied back in Colorado years ago, we were looking at photovoltaics, and they were claiming, and this is 20-something years ago, that coal-fired electricity was not really 6 cents a kilowatt hour. It was more like 45 cents a kilowatt hour because of things like black lung subsidies, as your guest has laid out, that the taxpayer basically pays the medical bill for the black lung. And there was also huge subsidies which came for the railroads or the barge shipping of it. And then, of course, the scrubbers were a subsidy. So the claim, you know, if you looked at your bill 30 years ago, it was claiming that you were paying 6 cents a kilowatt hour, but the true cost was 45 cents a kilowatt hour, and that extra 39 cents was the taxpayers that were chipping in. Now, with solar, of course, you know, you can buy a $200 panel and produce electricity for 40 years. So the idea that I'm just wondering whether or not the subsidies are being measured. And then the second part is that with all of this funk, all of the spewed ash that comes from coal-fired plants and the strip mining and whatnot, that's ruined a whole lot of other aspects of whether it's West Virginia or the other states that do a lot of coal mining. So fishing, it used to be sports fishing, used to be a huge industry.
I'm going to just ask you to just get to your question, David, and I appreciate your calling.
Well, if there's been a factor, you know, if the factor of what used to be, you know, income streams that used to be in various parts of the country, which were ruined by strip mining or, you know, the ruination of the streams.
Okay, thank you so much for calling. What about that? Has the damage to the environment, Jeff, actually made it hard for other industries to get a foothold and keep operating in this part of the country?
Oh, yeah. We see lots of examples of that. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful region. And so there is a great opportunity there for outdoor recreation tourism. And lots of communities are making that happen. And, you know, it's great. Whitewater rafting on the New River, you know, Fayetteville, West Virginia now has what I call an economy based on adrenaline, because it's either, you know, rock climbing or mountain biking or whitewater rafting and kayaking. It's just, you know, people who get a thrill from that spend a lot of money. That's great. But you look at other communities that have tried to do the same thing. Where I used to live near Morgantown, West Virginia, it's a lovely river called the Cheat River that unfortunately is heavily impacted by acid mine drainage, which kills off a lot of the aquatic life and stains the rocks orange. Locals call it yellow boy. Hmm. And it makes it harder, you know, if you're damaging the aesthetic resources of your greatest natural resource, in my opinion, which is your land and your water, it makes it harder to make other use of it. David also touches on a really important point here about the subsidies that are kind of masking the true costs. I mean, these are, you know, what economists call externalities. They are externalized by the industry. And that really is the, you know, that's the industry's game here, is to escape those true costs here in the final chapter and make sure that they're not the ones left to hold the bag.
Appalachia was an early site of the opioid epidemic that has now taken hold pretty much throughout the country. Why did it start there, and why were opioids in particular the class of drugs that caused so many addictions?
Well, this is another complicated thing that unfolded here. A combination of, first of all, just the outright greed by the pharmaceutical industries, and intentionally misrepresenting the risks associated with prescription opioids sort of set the stage for what was to come later. I want to mention a couple of other bodies of great work on this. Eric Ayer, formerly with the Charleston Gazette, wrote a wonderful book called Death in Mud Lick about this very thing, about all of these pain pills being pumped into these small communities. And Sam Quinones in his book Dreamland, I think, did a lovely job of unfolding a lot of this. But in a nutshell, you had the early arrival of this opioid crisis was showing up in coal-dependent communities, which is a curious thing. I think it's a combination of the sense of despair because of the few economic opportunities. And also, as the work life unraveled, we also saw an erosion of the social and cultural cohesion of some communities, which I think also contributed to addiction. And on top of that, I mean, this is a labor force that is disproportionately still doing physical labor. They're more inclined to get injured, and therefore they might end up in this situation where they're dependent on pain pills and vulnerable to addiction. But on top of all that, I think, you know, this thing we were talking about earlier about attitudes toward Appalachia, I think impeded us as a nation from really recognizing early on what was happening and addressing it. Just like it was easy to dismiss early Appalachian settlers in the pursuit of coal, it was easy to dismiss the addiction of Appalachians as somehow their own fault, right? I mean, just look at them, the way they talk, the way they live. What are you going to do? That sort of attitude. And that, I think, didn't just harm the people here. It ended up harming all of us. Because imagine if we had really paid attention to this thing, this crisis, when it first popped up, in towns like where I grew up. If we'd really paid attention and taken that seriously, just think of the damage that we might have prevented. And here we are now with a full-blown national addiction crisis.
How have some religious leaders in Appalachia had to change the way they think about substance abuse and the people who struggle with it in order to care for those folks who are not able to break free of their addictions?
Well, this has been a fascinating and really heartening thing to watch, is how faith leaders in communities have done some soul searching, so to speak, on their own part, and decided that they need to help people in need more than they need to pass judgment on people. And we see this unfolding in a lot of communities. And one of the really positive developments has been the proliferation of harm reduction programs. These can be needle exchange programs or, you know, safe havens for people to seek addiction treatment. And when we first started reporting on this, they were really rare. And now there are, there may be more than 100 in the region that we cover now. They're not without their own controversies. It's hard for people to get used to the idea, for example, of giving someone a clean needle so that they can continue to use a harmful drug. But once you acknowledge that using a dirty needle is far more hazardous to everyone in the community, it's kind of an easy choice.
How do the life experience of people in mining communities shape their politics?
Well, there is a strong sense of identity associated with mining. It's not just something you do, right? It's very often tied up in who you are. Mm. And so over time, there has been, and I think this is especially true with the decline of organized labor, there's been a stronger affiliation with the industry itself. So a very winning PR campaign has been built around the Friends of Coal. You can't drive through my home state of West Virginia or other parts of coal-producing Appalachia without seeing these Friends of Coal bumper stickers and billboards and T-shirts and hats and things like that. And so if you are against the industry, then you are assumed to be against the coal miner. But those aren't necessarily the same thing when you think about it. You know, the coal mining industry doesn't exist in order to employ coal miners. The industry exists to get coal out of the ground as cheaply as possible and sell it for the highest price possible. If the coal industry can do that without coal miners, they'll do it. In fact, that's the large trend story of employment in coal in Appalachia, has been automation displacing coal miners. It's not really about environmental laws, environmental rules. Sure, there are some environmental restrictions that add to their costs, as there should be, because of these externalities, these externalized costs that we've been talking about, right? Regulation is there to make them address those costs. The real thing that's been going on has been the combination of automation displacing people and more recently, competition from other forms of fuel, especially natural gas. But the way that plays out politically has been that because there are fewer alternative options for people, that the promise to bring coal back was very, very appealing. And we saw that certainly in the 2016 election, where the Trump campaign promised to bring back coal. It hasn't happened. There are fewer people working in coal now than there were when President Trump took office. And yet, the politics of the place is still deeply entrenched in that belief that coal might still come back, or that the people who are addressing climate change or addressing the costs of coal are their enemies, essentially. We need to find some way for people who want to restore these communities and have livable communities in Appalachia can have common cause and common outcome with people who want to address these very real problems, such as climate change.
This is Thank. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go next on the phone to Chase in Rockwall, Texas. Hi, Chase.
Hi. So I wanted to ask, I know they've done this in East Texas because there's a lot of reservoirs in East Texas, and because a lot of the oil has dried out in East Texas. But I'm not talking about Houston or those big cities. I'm talking about like in rural East Texas. a lot of the communities have revitalized their economy with tourism because they have a lot of reservoirs. And so they get Dallas people and Houston people to come to their city, and that's revitalized the economy. Like, all of the economy is basically now dependent on tourism. Why don't they do that in West Virginia?
Thanks for calling.
So as we mentioned earlier, there is a big growth in outdoor recreation tourism, very much like what Chase was describing there. However, a lot of the jobs associated with that are service jobs, and they're not very high pay jobs. Often they don't provide benefits. So if you were a coal miner and you were making $60,000, $70,000 and you had benefits and you could raise a family on that, suddenly your prospect is in the service industry making a fraction of that and likely without benefits. So that's part of the problem. Another issue is the revenue that was generated from coal extraction was closely tied to support for schools and other social services in these places. And that's been very hard to replace, even if a community is successful in developing other jobs. But I do think it's generally speaking, it's a bright spot, right? I don't want to downplay the positive aspects of outdoor recreation tourism. It's just that it's not by itself a panacea.
Briefly, what do you imagine the Ohio Valley might be like 20 years from now?
I think we're actually entering a very exciting phase. I think we're going to see, with the incoming new administration, I think the president-elect, Joe Biden, has already made clear his desire to be aggressive in how he addresses climate change. And I think there's a growing awareness that that has to include a just transition for energy-producing regions like Appalachia. And I think that opens up a whole range of possibilities for overdue infrastructure investment and all sorts of revitalization and diversification of local economies. There's so many people doing so much great work in these communities that I think if policymakers in Washington are smart and they pay attention to what's already happening at the community level, there's great opportunity.
Jeff Young is managing editor of the Ohio Valley Resource. That's a regional journalism collaborative. And he's author of Appalachian Fall, Dispatches from Coal Country on What's Ailing America. Jeff, thanks for making time for us today.
Thank you so much.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. The podcast is available wherever you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.